The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I will dive into the New Yorker archives and read two short stories. One by James Thurber, published in 1939, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. And another by Shirley Jackson, The Lottery, published in 1948. Now, from the March 18, 1939 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Fiction Department, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty by James Thurber. "We're going through!" The commander's voice was like thin ice breaking. He wore his full dress uniform with the heavily braided white cap pulled down rakishly over one cold gray eye. "We can't make it, sir. It's spoiling for a hurricane, if you ask me." "I'm not asking you, Lieutenant Berg," said the commander. "Throw on the power lights. Rev her up to 8,500. We're going through." The pounding of the cylinders increased. Ta-pocketa, pocketa, 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 pocketa. The commander stared at the ice forming on the pilot window. He walked over, twisted a row of complicated dials. "Switch on number 8 auxiliary," he shouted. "Switch on number 8 auxiliary," repeated Lieutenant Berg. "Full strength in number 3 turret," shouted the commander. "Full strength in number 3 turret." The crew, bending to their various tasks in the huge, hurtling, 8-engined Navy hydroplane, looked at each other and grinned. "The old man'll get us through," they said to one another. "The old man ain't afraid of hell." "Not so fast. You're driving too fast," said Mrs. Mitty. "Why are you driving so fast?" "Hmm?" said Walter Mitty. He looked at his wife in the seat beside him with shocked astonishment. She seemed grossly unfamiliar, like a strange woman who had yelled at him in a crowd. "You were up to 55, she said. "You know I don't like to go more than 40. You were up to 55. Walter Mitty drove on toward Waterbury in silence. The roaring of the SN-202 through the worst storm in 20 years of Navy flying fading in the remote, intimate airways of his mind. "You're all tensed up again," said Mrs. Mitty. "It's one of your days. I wish you'd let Dr. Renshaw look you over." Walter Mitty stopped the car in front of the building where his wife went to have her hair done. "Remember to get those overshoes while I'm having my hair done," she said.
"I don't need overshoes," said Mitty. She put her mirror back into her bag.
"We've been all through this," she said, getting out of the car. "You're not a young man any longer."
He raced the engine a little.
"Why don't you wear your gloves? Have you lost your gloves?"
Walter Mitty reached in a pocket and brought out the gloves. He put them on. But after she had turned and gone into the building, and he had driven on to a red light, he took them off again.
"Pick it up, brother," snapped a cop as the light changed, and Mitty hastily pulled on his gloves and lurched ahead. He drove around the streets aimlessly for a time, and then he drove past the hospital on his way to the parking lot.
"It's the millionaire banker, Wellington McMillan," said the pretty nurse.
"Yes," said Walter Mitty, removing his glasses slowly. "Who has the case?"
"Dr. Renshaw and Dr. Bimbo. But there are two specialists here, Dr. Remington from New York and Dr. Pritchett Mifford from London. He flew over."
A door opened down a long, cool corridor, and Dr. Renshaw came out. He looked distraught and haggard. "Hello, Mitty," he said. "We're having the devil's own time with McMillan, the millionaire banker and close personal friend of Roosevelt. Obstreosis of the ductal tract, tertiary. Wish you'd take a look at him."
"Glad to," said Mitty.
In the operating room, there were whispered introductions. "Dr. Remington, Dr. Mitty, Dr. Pritchett Mifford, Dr. Mitty." "I've read your book on streptothricosis," said Pritchett Mifford, shaking hands. "A brilliant performance, sir." "Thank you," said Walter Mitty.
"Didn't know you were in the States, Mitty," grumbled Remington. "Coles to Newcastle, bringing Mitford and me up here for a tertiary."
"You're very kind," said Mitty. A huge, complicated machine connected to the operating table with many tubes and wires began at this moment to go pocketa, pocketa, pocketa. The new anesthetizer is giving way, shouted an intern. There's no one in the East who knows how to fix it. Quiet, man, said Mitty in a low, cool voice. He sprang to the machine, which was now going pocket-a-pocket-a-queep, pocket-a-queep, pocket-a-queep. He began fingering delicately a row of glistening dials. Give me a fountain pen, he snapped. Someone handed him a fountain pen. He pulled a faulty piston out of the machine and inserted the pen in its place. That'll hold it for 10 minutes, he said. Now get on with the operation. A nurse hurried over and whispered to Renshaw, and Mitty saw the man turn pale. Choreopsis has set in, said Renshaw nervously. If you would take over, Mitty. Mitty looked at him, and at the craven figure of Benbo, who drank, and at the grave, uncertain faces of the two great specialists. If you wish, he said. They slipped a white gown on him. He adjusted a mask and drew on thin gloves. Nurses handed him shining.
Back it up, Mac. Look out for that Buick.
Walter Mitty jammed on the brakes.
Wrong lane, Mac,
said the parking lot attendant, looking at Mitty closely. Gee, yeah, muttered Mitty. He began cautiously to back out of the lane marked exit only.
Leave her sit there, said the attendant. I'll put her away.
Mitty got out of the car.
Hey, better leave the key.
Oh, said Mitty, handing the man the ignition key. The attendant vaulted into the car, backed it up with insolent skill, and put it where it belonged.
They're so damn cocky, thought Walter Mitty, walking along Main Street. They think they know everything.
Once he had tried to take his chains off outside New Milford, and he had got them wound around the axles. A man had had to come out in a wrecking car and unwind them, a young, grinning garage man. Since then, Mrs. Mitty always made him drive to a garage to have the chains taken off. The next time, he thought, I'll wear my right arm in a sling. They won't grin at me then. I'll have my right arm in a sling, and they'll see I couldn't possibly take the chains off myself. He kicked at the slush on the sidewalk. Overshoes, he said to himself, and he began looking for a shoe store. When he came out into the street again with the overshoes in a box under his arm, Walter Mitty began to wonder what the other thing was his wife had told him to get. She had told him twice before they set out from their house for Waterbury. In a way, he hated these weekly trips to town. He was always getting something wrong. Kleenex, he thought. Squibs? Razor blades? No. Toothpaste, toothbrush, bicarbonate, carborundum, initiative, and referendum. He gave it up. But she would remember it. Where's the what's-its-name, she would ask. Don't tell me you forgot the what's-its-name. A newsboy went by shouting something about the Waterbury trial.
Perhaps this will refresh your memory. The district attorney suddenly thrust a heavy automatic at the quiet figure on the witness stand. Have you ever seen this before?
Walter Mitty took the gun and examined it expertly.
Well, this is my Webley Vickers 50.8, he said calmly.
An excited buzz ran around the courtroom. The judge rapped for order.
You are a crack shot with any sort of firearm, I believe, said the district attorney insinuatingly.
Objection, shouted Mitty's attorney. We have shown that the defendant could not have fired the shot. We have shown that he wore his right arm in a sling on the night of the 14th of July.
Walter Mitty raised his hand briefly, and the bickering attorneys were stilled.
With any known make of gun, he said evenly, I could have killed Gregory Fitzhertz at 300 feet with my left hand.
Pandemonium broke loose in the courtroom. A woman's scream rose above the bedlam, and suddenly a lovely, dark-haired girl was in Walter Mitty's arms. The district attorney struck at her savagely. Without rising from his chair, Mitty let the man have it on the point of his chin.
You miserable cur!
Puppy biscuit, said Walter Mitty. He stopped walking, and the buildings of Waterbury rose up out of the misty courtroom and surrounded him again. A woman who was passing laughed.
He said puppy biscuit, she said to her pick companion. The man said puppy biscuit to himself.
He went into an A&P, not the first one he came to, but a smaller one further up the street. I want some biscuit for small young dogs, he said to the clerk. Any special brand, sir?
The greatest pistol shot in the world, thought a moment.
It says puppies bark for it on the box, said Walter Mitty.
His wife would be through at the hairdresser's in 15 minutes, Mitty saw in looking at his watch, unless they had trouble drying it. Sometimes they had trouble drying it. She didn't like to get to the hotel first. She would want him to be there waiting for her, as usual. He found a big leather chair in the lobby, facing a window, and he put the overshoes and the puppy biscuit on the floor beside him. He picked up an old copy of Liberty and sank down into the chair. Can Germany conquer the world through the air? Walter Mitty looked at the pictures of bombing planes and ruined streets.
The cannonading has got the wind up in young Raleigh, sir, said the sergeant.
Captain Mitty looked up at him through the tousled hair.
Get him to bed, he said wearily. With the others, I'll fly alone.
But you can't, sir, said the sergeant anxiously. It takes two men to handle the bomber, and the Archies are pounding hell out of the air. Von Richtmann's circus is between here and Saulier.
Well, somebody's got to get that ammunition dumped, said Mitty. I'm going over.
Throttle brandy? He poured a drink for the sergeant and one for himself. War thundered and whined around the dugout and battered at the door. There was a rending of wood and splinters flew through the room.
Bit of a near thing, said Captain Mitty carelessly.
The box barrage is closing in, said the sergeant.
Well, we only live once, sergeant, said Mitty with his faint, fleeting smile. Or do we?
He poured another brandy and tossed it off.
I never see a man could hold his brandy like you, sir, said the sergeant.
Begging your pardon, sir. Captain Mitty stood up, strapped on his huge Webley Vickers automatic.
It's 40 kilometers through hell, sir, said the sergeant.
Mitty finished one last brandy.
After all, he said softly, what isn't?
The pounding of the cannon increased. There was the rat-a-tat-tatting of machine guns, and from somewhere came the menacing pocket-a-pocket-a-pocket-a of the new flamethrowers.
Walter Mitty walked to the door of the dugout humming, A Prix de ma Blonde. He turned and waved to the sergeant.
Cheerio, he said.
Something struck his shoulder.
I've been looking all over this hotel for you, said Mrs. Mitty. Why do you have to hide in this old chair? How do you expect me to find you?
Things close in, said Walter Mitty vaguely.
What?
Mrs. Mitty said.
Did you get the what's-its-name? The puppy biscuit? What's in that box?
Overshoes, said Mitty.
Couldn't you put them on in the store?
I was thinking, said Walter Mitty.
Does it ever occur to you that I am sometimes thinking?
She looked at him.
I'm going to take your temperature when I get you home, she said.
They went out through the revolving doors that made a faintly derisive whistling sound when you pushed them. It was two blocks to the parking lot. At the drugstore on the corner, she said,
Wait here for me. I forgot something. I won't be a minute.
Well, she was more than a minute. Walter Mitty lighted a cigarette. It began to rain. Rain with sleet in it. He stood up against the wall of the drugstore smoking. He put his shoulders back and his heels together.
To hell with the handkerchief, said Walter Mitty scornfully.
He took one last drag on his cigarette and snapped it away. And then, with that faint, fleeting smile playing about his lips, he faced the firing squad, erect and motionless, proud and disdainful. Walter Mitty, the undefeated, inscrutable to the last. And now, from the June 26, 1948 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Fiction Department, The Lottery, by Shirley Jackson. The morning of June 27th was clear and sunny, with the fresh warmth of a full summer day. The flowers were blossoming profusely, and the grass was richly green. The people of the village began to gather in the square between the post office and the bank around 10 o'clock. In some towns, there were so many people that the lottery took 2 days and had to be started on June 26th. But in this village, where there were only about 300 people, the whole lottery took only about 2 hours. So it could begin at 10 o'clock in the morning and still be through in time to allow the villagers to get home for noon dinner. The children assembled first, of course. School was recently over for the summer, and the feeling of liberty sat uneasily on most of them. They tended to gather together quietly for a while before they broke into boisterous play, and their talk was still of the classroom and of the teacher and of books and reprimands. Bobby Martin had already stuffed his pockets full of stones, and the other boys soon followed, selecting the smoothest and roundest stones. Bobby and Harry Jones and Dickie Delacroix eventually made a great pile of stones in one corner of the square and guarded it against the raids of the other boys. The girls stood aside, talking among themselves, looking over their shoulders at the boys, and the very small children rolled in the dust or clung to the hands of their elder brothers or sisters. Soon, the men began to arrive, surveying their own children, speaking of planting and rain, tractors, and taxes. They stood together, away from the pile of stones in the corner, and their jokes were quiet, and they smiled rather than laughed. The women, wearing faded house dresses and sweaters, came shortly after their menfolk. They greeted one another and exchanged bits of gossip as they went to join their husbands. Soon, the women, standing by their husbands, began to call to their children, and the children came reluctantly, having to be called 4 or 5 times. Bobby Martin ducked under his mother's grasping hand and ran, laughing, back to the pile of stones. His father spoke up sharply, and Bobby came quickly and took his place between his father and his oldest brother. The lottery was conducted, as were the square dances, teenage club, the Halloween program, by Mr. Summers, who had time and energy to devote to civic activities. He was a round-faced, jovial man, and he ran the coal business, and people were sorry for him, because he had no children, and his wife was a scold. When he arrived in the square carrying the black wooden box, there was a murmur of conversation among the villagers, and he waved and called, "Little late today, folks." The postmaster, Mr. Graves, followed him, carrying a 3-legged stool, and the stool was put in the center of the square, and Mr. Summers set the black box down on it. The villagers kept their distance, leaving a space between themselves and the stool. And when Mr. Summers said, "Some of you fellows want to give me a hand?" there was a hesitation before two men, Mr. Harton and his oldest son Baxter, came forward to hold the box steady on the stool while Mr. Summers stirred up the papers inside it. The original paraphernalia for the lottery had been lost long ago, and the black box now resting on the stool had been put into use even before old man Warner, the oldest man in the town, was born. Mr. Summers spoke frequently to the villagers about making a new box, but no one liked to upset even as much tradition as was represented by the black box. There was a story that the present box had been made with some pieces of the box that had preceded it, the one that had been constructed when the first people settled down to make a village here. Every year, after the lottery, Mr. Summers began talking again about a new box. But every year, the subject was allowed to fade off without anything being done. The black box grew shabbier each year. By now, it was no longer completely black, but splintered badly along one side to show the original wood color, and in some places faded or stained. Mr. Martin and his oldest son, Baxter, held the black box securely on the stool until Mr. Summers had stirred the papers thoroughly with his hand. Because so much of the ritual had been forgotten or discarded, Mr. Summers had been successful in having slips of paper substituted for the chips of wood that had been used for generations. Chips of wood, Mr. Summers had argued, had been all very well when the village was tiny. But now that the population was more than 300 and likely to keep on growing, it was necessary to use something that would fit more easily into the black box. The night before the lottery, Mr. Summers and Mr. Graves made up the slips of paper and put them into the box. And it was then taken to the safe of Mr. Summers' coal company and locked up until Mr. Summers was ready to take it to the square next morning. The rest of the year, the box was put away, sometimes one place, sometimes another. It had spent 1 year in Mr. Graves' barn and another year underfoot in the post office. And sometimes it was set on a shelf in the Martin grocery and left there. There was a great deal of fussing to be done before Mr. Summers declared the lottery open. There were the lists to make up of heads of family, heads of households in each family, members of each household in each family. There was the proper swearing in of Mr. Summers by the postmaster as the official of the lottery. At one time, some people remembered, there had been a recital of some sort performed by the official of the lottery, a perfunctory, tuneless chant that had been rattled off duly each year. Some people believed that the official of the lottery used to stand just so when he said or sang it. Others believed that he was supposed to walk among the people. But years and years ago, this part of the ritual had been allowed to lapse. There had been, also, a ritual salute, which the official of the lottery had had to use in addressing each person who came up to draw from the box. But this also had changed with time. Until now, it was felt necessary only for the official to speak to each person approaching. Mr. Summers was very good at all this. In his clean white shirt and blue jeans, with one hand resting carelessly on the black box, he seemed very proper and important as he talked interminably to Mr. Graves and the Martins. Just as Mr. Summers finally left off talking and turned to the assembled villagers, Mrs. Hutchison came hurriedly along the path to the square, her sweater thrown over her shoulders and slid into place in the back of the crowd. "Clean forgot what day it was," she said to Mrs. Delacroix, who stood next to her, and they both laughed softly. "Thought my old man was out back stacking wood," Mrs. Hutchison went on, "and then I looked out the window, and the kids was gone. And then I remembered it was the 27th and came a-running." She dried her hands in her apron. And Mrs. Delacroix said, "You're in time, though. They're still talking way up there. They're still talking away up there." Mrs. Hutchison craned her neck to see through the crowd and found her husband and children standing near the front. She tapped Mrs. Delacroix on the arm as a farewell and began to make her way through the crowd. The people separated good-humoredly to let her through. Two or the three people said, in voices just loud enough to be heard across the crowd, "Here comes your Mrs. Hutchison," and "Bill, she made it after all." Mrs. Hutchison reached her husband, and Mr. Summers, who had been waiting, said cheerfully, "Thought we were going to have to get on without you, Tessie," Mrs. Hutchison said, grinning. "Wouldn't have had me leave my dishes in the sink now, would you, Joe?" And soft laughter ran through the crowd as the people stirred back into position after Mrs. Hutchison's arrival. "Well, now," Mr. Summers said soberly, "guess we better get started and get this over with so as we can get back to work. Anybody ain't here?" "Dunbar," several people said. "Dunbar, Dunbar." Mr. Summers consulted his list. "Clyde Dunbar," he said. "That's right. He broke his leg, hadn't he? Who's drawing for him?" "Me, I guess," a woman said, and Mr. Summers turned to look at her. "Wife draws for her husband." Mr. Summers said, "Don't you have a grown boy to do it for you, Janie?" Although Mr. Summers and everyone else in the village knew the answer perfectly well, it was the business of the official of the lottery to ask such questions formally. Mr. Summers waited with an expression of polite interest while Mrs. Dunbar answered. "Horse is not but 16 yet," Mrs. Dunbar said regretfully. "Guess I got to fill in for the old man this year." "Right," Mr. Summers said. He made a note on the list he was holding. Then he asked, "Watson boy drawing this year?" A tall boy in the crowd raised his hand. "Here," he said, "I'm drawing from a mother and me." He blinked his eyes nervously and ducked his head as several voices in the crowd said things like, "Good fellow, Jack, and glad to see your mother's got a man to do it." "Well," Mr. Summers said, "guess that's everyone. Old man Warner make it?" "Here," a voice said, and Mr. Summers nodded. A sudden hush fell on the crowd as Mr. Summers cleared his throat and looked at the list. "All ready?" he called. "Now I'll read the names,
Heads of families first, and the men come up and take a paper out of the box. Keep the paper folded in your hand without looking at it until everyone has had a turn. Everything clear? The people had done it so many times that they only half listened to the directions. Most of them were quiet, wetting their lips, not looking around. Then Mr. Summers raised one hand high and said, "Adams!" A man disengaged himself from the crowd and came forward. "Hi, Steve," Mr. Summers said, and Mr. Adams said, "Hi, Joe." They grinned at one another humorlessly and nervously. Then Mr. Adams reached into the black box and took out a folded paper. He held it firmly by one corner as he turned and went hastily back to his place in the crowd, where he stood a little apart from his family, not looking down at his hand.
"Allen," Mr. Summers said. "Anderson, Bentham."
"Seems like there's no time at all between lotteries anymore," Mrs. Delacroix said to Mrs. Graves in the back row. "Seems like we got through with the last one only last week."
"Time sure goes fast," Mrs. Graves said.
"Clark, Delacroix."
"Well, there goes my old man," Mrs. Delacroix said. She held her breath while her husband went forward.
"Dunbar," Mr.
Summers said. And Mrs. Dunbar went steadily to the box while one of the women said,
"Go on, Janie."
And another said,
"There she goes."
"We're next," Mrs. Graves said. She watched while Mr. Graves came around from the side of the box, greeted Mr. Summers gravely, and selected a slip of paper from the box. By now, all through the crowd, there were men holding the small folded papers in their large hands, turning them over and over nervously. Mrs. Dunbar and her two sons stood together, Mrs. Dunbar holding the slip of paper.
"Harbert! Hutchinson!"
"Get up there, Bill,"
Mrs. Hutchinson said, and the people near her laughed.
"Jones?"
"They do say," Mr. Adams said to old man Warner, who stood next to him, "that over in the North Village they're talking of giving up the lottery." Old man Warner snorted.
"Pack of crazy fools," he said. "Listening to the young folks, there's nothing good enough for them. Next thing you know, they'll be wanting to go back to living in caves. Nobody work anymore. Live that way for a while. Used to be a saying about lottery in June, corn be heavy soon. First thing you know, we'll all be eating stewed chickweed and acorns. There's always been a lottery," he said petulantly. "Bad enough to see young Joe Summers up there joking with everybody."
"Some places have already quit lotteries," Mrs. Adams said.
"Nothing but trouble in that," old man Warner said stoutly. "Pack of young fools."
"Martin,"
and Bobby Martin watched his father go forward.
"Overdyke, Percy."
"I wish they'd hurry," Mrs. Dunbar said to her older son. "I wish they'd hurry."
"Well, they're almost through," her son said. "You get ready to run tell Dad," Mrs. Dunbar said.
Mr. Summers called his own name and then stepped forward precisely and selected a slip from the box. And then he called,
"Warner."
77th year I've been in the lottery,"
old man Warner said as he went through the crowd.
77th time.
"Watson?"
The tall boy came awkwardly through the crowd. Someone said,
"Don't be nervous, Jack."
And Mr. Summers said, "Take your time, son."
"Zanini."
After that, there was a long pause, a breathless pause, until Mr. Summers, holding his slip of paper in the air, said,
"All right, fellows."
For a minute, no one moved, and then all of the slips of paper were opened. Suddenly, all the women began to speak at once, saying,
"Who is it? Who's got it? Is it the Dunbars? Is it the Watsons?"
Then the voices began to say,
"It's Hutchinson. It's Bill. Bill Hutchinson's got it."
Go tell your father, Mrs. Dunbar said to her older son. People began to look around to see the Hutchinsons. Bill Hutchinson was standing quiet, staring down at the paper in his hand. Suddenly, Tessie Hutchinson shouted to Mr. Summers,
"You didn't give him enough time enough to take the paper that he wanted. I saw you. It wasn't fair."
"Be a good sport, Tessie," Mrs. Delacroix called, and Mrs. Graves said, "All of us took the same chance."
"Shut up, Tessie," Bill Hutchinson said. "Well, everyone," Mr. Summers said, "that was done pretty fast, and now we've got to be hurrying a little more to get done in time."
He consulted his next list. Bill, he said, you draw for the Hutchinson family. You got any other households in the Hutchinsons?
There's Don and Eva, Mrs. Hutchinson yelled. Make them take their chance.
Daughters draw with their husbands' families, Tessie, Summer said gently. You know that as well as anyone else.
It wasn't fair, Tessie said.
I guess not, Joe, Bill Hutchinson said regretfully. My daughter draws with her husband's family. That's only fair. And I've got no other family except the kids. Then, as far as drawing for families is concerned, it's you, Mr. Summers said in explanation. And as far as drawing for households is concerned, that's you too. Right?
Right, Bill Hutchinson said. How many kids, Bill? Mr. Summers asked formally.
Three, Bill Hutchinson said. There's Bill Jr. and Nancy and little Dave and Tessie and me.
All right, then, Mr. Summers says. Harry, you got their tickets back?
Mr. Graves nodded and held up the slips of paper.
Put them in the box, then, Mr. Summers directed. Take Bill's and put it in.
I think we ought to start over, Mrs. Hutchinson said as quietly as she could. I tell you, it wasn't fair. You didn't give him enough time to choose. Everybody saw that.
Mr. Graves had selected the five slips and put them in the box, and he dropped all the papers but those onto the ground, where the breeze caught them and lifted them off.
Listen, everybody, Mrs. Hutchinson was saying to the people around her.
Ready, Bill? Mr. Summers asked,
and Bill Hutchinson, with one quick glance around at his wife and children, nodded.
Remember, Mr. Summers said, take the slips and keep them folded until each person has taken one. Harry, you help little Dave.
Mr. Graves took the hand of the little boy who came willingly with him up to the box.
Take a paper out of the box, Davy, Mr. Summers said.
Davy put his hand into the box and laughed.
Just take one paper, Mr. Summers said.
Harry, you hold it for him. Mr. Graves took the child's hands and removed the folded paper from the tight fist and held it while little Dave stood next to him and looked up at him wonderingly.
Nancy next, Mr. Summers said.
Nancy was 12, and her school friends breathed heavily as she went forward, switching her skirt and took a slip daintily from the box.
Bill Jr., Mr. Summers said.
And Billy, his face red and his feet overlarge, nearly knocked the box over as he got a paper out.
Tessie,
Mr. Summers said. She hesitated for a minute, looking around defiantly, and then set her lips and went up to the box. She snatched a paper out and held it behind her.
Bill, Mr. Summers said.
And Bill Hutchinson reached into the box and felt around, bringing his hand out at last with the slip of paper in it. The crowd was quiet. A girl whispered,
I hope it's not Nancy.
And the sound of the whisper reached the edges of the crowd.
It's not the way it used to be, old man Warner said clearly. People ain't the way they used to be.
All right, Mr. Summers said, open the papers. Harry, you open little Dave's.
Mr. Graves opened the slip of paper, and there was a general sigh through the crowd as he held it up, and everyone could see that it was blank. Nancy and Bill, Jr., opened theirs at the same time, and both beamed and laughed, turning around to the crowd and holding their slips of paper above their head.
Tessie, Mr. Summers said.
There was a pause, and then Mr. Summers looked at Bill Hutchinson, and Bill unfolded his paper and showed it. It was blank.
It's Tessie, Mr. Summers said, and his voice was hushed.
Show us her paper, Bill. Bill Hutchinson went over to his wife, forced a slip of paper out of her hand. It had a black spot on it, the black spot Mr. Summers had made the night before with the heavy pencil in the coal company office. Bill Hutchinson held it up, and there was a stir in the crowd.
All right, folks, Mr. Summers said, let's finish quickly.
Although the villagers had forgotten the ritual and lost the original black box, they still remembered to use stones. The pile of stones the boys had made earlier was ready. There were stones in the ground with the blowing scraps of paper that had come out of the box. Mrs. Delacroix selected a stone so large she had to pick it up with both hands and turned to Mrs. Dunbar.
Come on, she said, hurry up.
Mrs. Dunbar had small stones in both hands, and she said, gasping for breath,
I can't rent at all. You have to go ahead. I'll catch up with you.
The children had stones already, and someone gave little Davy Hutchison a few pebbles. Tessie Hutchison was in the center of a cleared space by now. She held her hands out desperately as the villagers moved into her.
It isn't fair, she said.
A stone hit her on the side of the head. Old man Warner was saying,
come on, everyone.
Steve Adams was in the front of the crowd of villagers with Mrs. Graves beside him.
It isn't fair. It isn't right, Mrs. Hutchison screamed,
and then they were upon her. And now, from the March 9th, 2020 edition of the New Yorker magazine, the books section, The Leveler, Thomas Piketty Goes Global in Capital and Ideology by Idris Kaloun. Speaking in 1918, with Europe ravaged by the horrors of modern warfare and Russia in the hands of the Bolsheviks, Irving Fisher warned his colleagues at the annual meeting of the American Economic Association of a great peril, that peril which risked perverting the democracy for which we have just been fighting, was extreme inequality. We may be sure that there will be a bitter struggle over the distribution of wealth, Fisher, perhaps the most celebrated economist of his day, maintained. More than a century later, at another annual meeting of the American Economic Association, the specter once more loomed over the discipline. American capitalism and democracy are not working for people without a college degree, Ann Case, an economist at Princeton, declared in January as she flipped through slides in a large windowless conference room. On a screen, charts showed breathtaking increases in suicide, drug overdoses, and alcoholism among less educated whites over the past two decades. These deaths of despair, as she and her husband collaborator Angus Deaton called them, originated in the deep unfairness of American society. When Fisher issued his warning, the richest 10% of Americans were taking home 41% of all domestic income. Today, they take 48%. If inequality has become the subject of intense public attention, a good deal of the credit goes to the French economist Thomas Piketty. In 2014, Capital in the 21st Century, a dense tome published in English by an academic press, became an unlikely global bestseller. There are more than 2 million copies in print. Previously, Piketty, who teaches at the Paris School of Economics, had been an academic luminary, but not a public one. The focus of his research, inequality, had long been a niche subject. Timing and talent catapulted him to fame. His book perfectly fit the post-Occupy Wall Street ethos, providing empirical rigor for the upswell in anger. The wounds of the Great Recession had hardly scabbed over. Disillusionment with the rich and powerful verged on Jacobianism. The moment was ripe for a grand iconoclastic theory, and that's exactly what Piketty provided, with detailed figures and lucid prose. In earlier work, he and a frequent collaborator, the economist Emmanuel Saez, had the innovative idea of framing inequality in terms of the top 1% share versus everyone else's, eschewing the discipline's usual formula of Gini coefficients, which are meaningless to the masses, and identifying a clear common enemy. The problem was inherent in capitalism itself. Over the past century, the rate of return on capital and existing wealth owned disproportionately by the rich had exceeded the growth in the economy as a whole. They had created a chasm of inequality comparable to what existed during the Gilded Age, before the gilding was removed by two cataclysmic world wars and the Great Depression. You could distill the core of Piketty's theory down to three characters and emblazing the formula on a T-shirt, something that nerdier subgroups of the population actually did. Success has launched Piketty into the venerated position of the French global intellectual, like Pierre Boudou, Michel Foucault and Claude Levi-Strauss before him. Le Monde hosts his blog. He was enlisted as an advisor by a 2017 French presidential campaign of the Socialist Party candidate Benoît Hamon. He'd previously advised another such candidate, Ségolène Royal. And now, as if to secure his preeminence in this role, Piketty has published a yet more ambitious book, Capital and Ideology, published by Harvard. It encompasses history, political science, and political theory, and is even more voluminous than its predecessor. This reviewer must report that the 1,100-page work broke an unadmittedly unsteady card table and later caused a carry-on to exceed the weight limit on an admittedly stingy European airline. There's a reason for the heft. Capital and Ideology sets out not only to describe capitalism, but also to help us transcend it. Piketty both diagnoses and prescribes. He tries to expose the contradictions of the reigning ideology of hypercapitalism and its malign consequences, including a populist nativist backlash, and to stave off disaster, recommends a breathtaking series of reforms. They include a schedule of taxation on income and wealth that reaches 90% and the elimination of nation states in favor of, quote, a vast transnational democracy, end quote, which will secure a universal right to education and a capital endowment, free circulation of people, and de facto virtual abolition of borders. A serious disease, Piketty believes, calls for strong medicine. Capital and Ideology opens with an arresting pronouncement. Every human society must justify its inequalities unless reasons for them are found. The whole political and social edifice stands in danger of collapse. War, recession, religion, every facet of human existence has its roots in inequality, Piketty tells us. Indeed, he uses society and inequality regime almost interchangeably. If there are hazards in such a monocausal account, it may be a necessary simplification in the quest to anatomize social organization from the Middle Ages to modernity. Adopting a theory of the French philologist Georges Dumézil, Piketty writes that early societies were trifunctional, in ways largely determined by birth. You were a member of the clergy, the warrior nobility, or the peasantry. Something similar, he notes, can be seen in Planet of the Apes and Star Wars. During this period of limited mobility, inequality was justified by the notion that the castes were interdependent, like the limbs of the body. If someone gets to be the brains, then someone else has to be the feet. After the development of the central state and later disruptions, like the French Revolution, inequality was taken to be a necessary feature of ownership societies, premised on individual liberty, but also on the sacralization of private property. In the 20th century, this model fell apart. The ideology of the self-regulated market in the 19th century led to the destruction of European societies in the period of 1914 to 1945, and ultimately to the death of economic liberalism. Piketty writes, "We know now that this death was only temporary. In the post-war era, societies drifted into either social democracy, which Piketty thinks is flawed, but closest to his ideal society, or communism, which failed utterly. What ensued was the revenge of the ownership society. The dominant ideology of the modern era, in Piketty's view, has been one of neo-proprietarianism, in which private property rights are worshipped above all, auguring another disaster." Spenglerian in scope, Piketty's critique reaches far back into history and across the globe. He explores the inequality regimes in Mughal India, slave colonies in the West Indies, and post-Soviet republics. It's an admirable corrective to the usual Eurocentrism of Western economists, even if most readers will feel the impulse to skip ahead 400 pages to the discussion of modern economies. Piketty has modified his thinking since his previous opus. rather than imply that rising inequality is a problem inherent in capitalism, he now suggests that the levels of inequality we get are the ones we countenance, that they're entirely a matter of political and ideological choices. His famous formula, R is greater than G, has all but disappeared. In his retelling, the so-called Trente Gloriosus, the 30 years of relative equality between 1950 and 1980, were the result not of two world wars, which played only a minor part in this collapse, he has determined, but rather of political decisions made to reduce the social influence of private property. And the politics we adopt certainly do influence inequality. Steeply progressive income taxes and estate taxes shaped income distributions during those Trente Gloriosus. Consider, for that matter, how corporations and the very rich are indulged by the current taxation regime in the West. Tax collection agencies are resigned to the fact that the biggest fortunes also tend to be the most mobile. In the U.S., many states compete to provide rich people with advantageous tax rates in order not to lose them. But whatever revenue is gained by holding on to some fortunes is more than undercut by the diminished rates. Since Congress passed its 2017 package of tax cuts, which Republican sponsors justified on global competition grounds and claimed would pay for itself, corporate tax collections have fallen by a third. The U.S. is now running trillion-dollar deficits during a period of long-lasting economic growth, no major military engagements, and no ramp-up in social spending. What's more, when states start taxing mobile assets less, they also usually start taxing immobile assets more. And immobile assets, like homes, are usually the only ones working people have. Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zuckman have argued in a recent book of their own, The Triumph of Injustice, that effective tax rates on the rich have declined so much in the U.S. that the tax system is now flat, even regressive. The Congressional Budget Office recently estimated that post-tax inequality will continue to climb, with the country's top 1% earning 3.1% more each year, while the bottom 20% earns just 1% more per year. Meanwhile, Piketty estimates, 10% of the global financial assets are now stashed in tax havens. Ireland, a favorite haven for American companies, had to start publishing modified national economic statistics because of all the foreign assets it harbors. In theory, international taxation could be harmonized by treaties in the way countries have come together to ban certain kinds of munitions or pollutants. So far, there hasn't been the will. This picture is discouraging, if it's also familiar. That is a tribute, in part, to the success of Piketty's previous work. The most interesting findings in the Second Capital come from his forays into political science. He argues that the Brahmin left, the most educated citizens and the greatest beneficiaries of the knowledge economy and the supposed meritocracy has captured their left-wing parties in Western democracies, distracting those parties from their mission of improving the lives of working people. Conservative parties, meanwhile, are under the sway of the merchant right. Such polarization makes debate over redistribution impossible, and so the lower classes debate immigration and borders instead. For left-wing parties to win back working people, Piketty says, they will have to reverse this effect. He wants to reignite arguments about inequality in order to dampen nativist furor. Yet this is scarcely a surefire formula. The simple push for more redistribution may worsen a nativist backlash if a lot of voters think they're funding people who aren't their kind, minorities. In places like Britain and France, there's anger over welfare benefits to immigrants. In America, the fissures run deeper still. The Halcyon post-war days of political comity were shattered by the strife over civil rights, which permanently realigned politics. The Democratic Party continued to advocate for ever greater redistribution, as with the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson or the ensuing affirmative action policies, among other measures that Piketty praises, only to run into an identitarian backlash among the white working class. In Reagan-era America, this was expressed in the racially coded anxiety over welfare queens. Later efforts to ramp up the welfare state, such as Barack Obama's ambitious expansion of Medicaid to the benefit of many poor white Americans, have also become embroiled in the fraught politics of race. Here's where any monocausal account is bound to run into trouble. As political factors, race and redistribution relate in ways too complex to be captured in a formula. In Capital in the 21st Century, Piketty made a policy proposal that he cautioned was probably utopian, a global tax on wealth topping out at around 2%. Half a dozen years later, it seems almost like milk toastery. The signature idea of Elizabeth Warren's presidential candidacy is a wealth tax with a top rate of 6% in order to fund her Medicare for All plan. Bernie Sanders' tax plan tops out at 8%. As the Overton window shifts, Piketty has made sure to stay well ahead of it. In his new plan, America would raise its taxes high enough to collect 50% of national income each year, roughly $10 trillion, or three times as much as the federal government currently takes in. With this cash, the government would not only fund universal health care and higher education, but offer everyone a basic income floor equivalent to 60% of average after-tax income. On your 25th birthday, you'd also get a cash payout of $231,000, the equivalent of 60% of the average adult's net worth. Piketty has called this system of capital endowment inheritance for all. It's enough to make Sanders blush. Piketty isn't capable of pragmatism. Many of his suggestions, establishing a fair, progressive tax system, ensuring that poor children have access to higher education, could be addressed within the framework of today's inequality regime, which is to say, contemporary capitalism. The same applies to his call for raising minimum wages, expanding rent control, and giving workers seats on corporate boards, even if these are heterodox recommendations in mainstream economics. And yet, theory of everything treatises like Piketty's ultimately seek provocation, not practicality. And Piketty concludes that such proposals are not enough to achieve true liberation. It seems obvious that the only way to transcend capitalism and ownership society is to work out some way of transcending the nation state, he writes. We'll need a true participatory and internationalist socialism, he says, in order to free humanity from the contradictions of capitalism in which it is so harmfully enmeshed. Of course, the people who are most likely to hear and heed Piketty's call to action, whether or not they scythe their way through his book, are all of the Brahmin left. Throughout the book, Piketty heaps praise on Sanders, Warren, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the British Labour Party. Corbyn recently campaigned on perhaps the most unabashedly redistributionist manifesto in the party's history. It called for transferring control of 10% of big companies to workers, nationalizing other companies, and instituting a four-day work week, and then suffered catastrophic losses in working-class labor strongholds. Perhaps that's because Corbyn simply wasn't bold enough. But if a candidate were to go to the full Piketty by proposing enormous taxes on the rich and taking steps towards surrendering sovereignty to a transnational socialistic union, do we really think that nativism and nationalism would retreat rather than redouble? Would erstwhile supporters of Nigel Farage, Marine Le Pen, Donald Trump, and Geert Wilders evolve beyond their fears of Muslim migration and accept the new utopia? The challenge for the existing political order in affluent countries is to show that it can effectively address problems like poverty and precarity. In America, poverty is increasingly concentrated and thus more corrosive, while absolute economic mobility looks to be at a low point. So what might reform that falls short of revolution look like? Creating a universal child allowance of $300 a month may sound like a boring technocratic fix, and at an annual cost of $100 billion, or less than half of what's budgeted for Veterans Affairs, it certainly wouldn't require expropriating the fortunes of the top 1%. Yet it would have child poverty all on its own. Tripling federal funding for poor schools, which would go a long way to improving mobility and reducing the inheritability of misfortune, would raise costs by a relatively paltry $30 billion a year. Reforming housing assistance so that adults who receive rent subsidies are no longer crammed into ghettos is another measure that's very much within reach and would substantially improve the lives of their children. Imagine a congregation of economists 100 years in the future. Maybe we're on the moon. Maybe we're on Mars. Either way, the scene isn't hard to sketch. It will probably still be in a large, windowless room. Inequality at the top end of the income distribution could very well look even more lopsided than it does now. But whether inequality is the topic of the keynote address may depend more on the progress against poverty and middle-class stagnation than on the number of newly minted trillionaires. Well, we have time for a cartoon or two. In the first cartoon, we see a painter in the studio with a very large, beautiful, completed painting of people at the lake. And the painter is looking at the painting, and he thinks, this would make a great jigsaw puzzle. In the next cartoon, a flock of sheep are grazing, and one sheep says to the other, Myra, if you really mean it about restructuring, let's lose the shepherd and keep the sheepdogs. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call, and I'd love to hear from you, 919-832-5138. Or send me an email to info@ncreadingservice.org. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.